Think of the most moving painting you've ever seen.
Like the kind that just stops you dead in your tracks in a gallery.
Exactly. The kind where you just feel this sudden, really resonant wave of human emotion.
Yeah, it's a powerful feeling.
Right? And chances are, when you picture that painting, you're picturing a face,
Most likely, yeah.
a subtle smile, a tear, or I don't know, maybe just a weary slump of a shoulder. We're biologically hardwired to look for ourselves on the canvas, right? Searching for those physical cues we can empathize with.
We want to see humanity looking back at us.
Right. But today we're looking at a masterpiece of modern loneliness. And, well, there isn't a single human in it.
Which is incredibly hard to pull off. I mean, to communicate such an immense, burdensome human condition while entirely stripping away the human figure, it requires a highly specific mastery of
You
atmosphere.
really have to build the environment.
Exactly. You have to build an environment that forces the viewer to feel the isolation rather than just, showing them a lonely person.
And the artwork we are plunging into today on this deep dive does exactly that. It's a recently created watercolor. It's titled Solo, painted in March of 2025 by the artist Jairo Duke.
It's a stunning piece.
It really is. And you can actually visualize it alongside us today. The piece is hosted online over at artcolaragua.com.
Definitely worth pulling up if you can.
Yeah, for sure. But what makes this specific deep dive so unusual is our source material. We aren't just critiquing a finished image hanging on a white wall,
No, we actually have rare, transparent access to the artist's own mind.
which is so cool. We're pulling from a highly revealing technical document penned by Duke himself. It's titled Trastio Gu Pintura Artistica.
Basically, a map of his creative moves.
Exactly. He credits a reference photographer for the initial visual spark, and he even notes his daily studio location, which was in Whittier, California.
Those notes offer an incredibly transparent look into the mental scaffolding of the artwork.
Okay, let's unpack this scaffolding, because usually we just consume the final product. But our mission today is to decode the anatomy of isolation by unpacking the literal physical layers of this artwork.
And then connecting them to the psychological weight it carries.
Right. And going through these notes, man, the physical choices Duke makes are extreme. Like for any art students tuning in, his specifications sound more like structural engineering than painting.
They really do.
He specifies Daniel Smith brand watercolors on Arch's cold-pressed, rough grain paper.
Very specific.
Yeah, and the format is 15 by 22 inches, but the paper itself is 640 grams. So why is that specific number so important?
Well, the weight of the paper is essentially the foundation of everything that happens emotionally in this piece.
Really, just the paperweight.
Yeah, because, to put 640 grams into perspective for you, think about a standard piece of printer paper sitting on your desk.
Okay.
That is roughly 80 grams.
Wow, okay.
And if you go to a craft store and buy, like, a beginner's pad of watercolor paper, that's usually around 300 grams.
So 640 grams is double that.
Exactly. It's basically a rigid plank of wood.
Wait, if it's that thick, why not just paint on a canvas or a literal board? I mean, why insist on watercolor paper if you need it to be that indestructible?
Because of how watercolor behaves, the paper in a watercolor painting is never just a passive background, it's an active collaborator.
Oh, I see.
If a painter uses that standard 300-gram paper and applies too much water, the structural integrity of the paper just fails.
It buckles and warps, right?
Exactly. It buckles, it warps, and you get those unintended puddles where the paper physically bends.
Right, which ruins the effect.
Yeah. So by choosing a 640-gram paper, Duke is making a deliberate physical decision that allows him to literally inundate the surface with massive amounts of water without the paper warping a single millimeter.
He is just flooding it.
Completely flooding it.
And because he's using cold-pressed rough grain paper, that surface isn't smooth,
Oh,
right?
far from it.
Yeah.
If you were to look at that rough grain paper under a microscope, it would resemble a rugged mountain range.
Just full of steep peaks and deep valleys.
Exactly.
You know, hearing you describe the water hitting that microscopic terrain, it almost reminds me of film photography.
Oh, how so?
Like how modern digital photography is hyper-perfect and clinical, you know, with flawless pixels and zero noise.
Right, you very clean.
But when you shoot on analog film, you get physical grain. You get texture. And those tiny physical imperfections somehow tell a much more genuine human story than a clean digital file.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it, actually. Duke is intentionally sacrificing clinical precision to let the materials have a voice of their own.
He wants that grain.
Yes. When he floods that microscopic mountain range with heavy granular pigments, which, by the way, is a defining characteristic of the Daniel Smith watercolors he uses, pure physics takes over.
The pigment just does its own thing.
Right. The heavy particles of color physically sink and settle into those tiny valleys in the paper, leaving the peaks slightly more exposed.
Which means the painting avoids that artificial, flat, plastic look entirely. It creates an organic, tactile visual vibration. I mean, the texture becomes something you can almost feel with your eyes.
It's very visceral.
But the fact that this thick paper can hold so much water leads to another pretty bizarre element in his notes. He talks about how this flooding process essentially turns the painting into a physical record of time.
Yes, and this brings us to a technique called veladoris.
Veladoris, okay.
It's central to how the main focal point of this painting is constructed, and that focal point is an immense unyielding wall.
Right, the big wall.
So a veladora, or a glaze, is a technique where you apply a highly translucent, watery layer of color over a previous layer of paint that is completely dried.
Oh, it's like stacking panes of tinted glass on top of each other.
That's a perfect analogy.
It's letting the light travel down through all the layers and bounce back up.
Precisely. But here is the critical part of Duke's process in that Whittier, California studio.
Okay, what is it?
When he applies these inundating layers of water to this 640-gram paper, he refuses to speed up the drying process.
No artificial heat.
None. No hair dryers, no heat lamps.
But wait, the notes also say he doesn't correct the watermark.
Right, he leaves them.
But when a pool of water evaporates naturally, it leaves a hard, distinct edge where the pigment settles at the boundary, doesn't it?
It does.
My middle school art teacher always told me that was an amateur mistake. Like, you're supposed to blend those out. Why would a master let the painting look scarred like that?
Because treating them as mistakes assumes the goal is perfect. Artificial control.
Oh, interesting.
Duke views those hard edges as intentional scars. He wants the evaporation to dictate the final look.
He's giving up control.
Exactly. Because he does this, that vast wall dominating the composition ceases to be just a flat architectural feature. Mm. Duke poetically refers to it in his notes as a breathing wall.
A breathing wall. Wow.
Yeah.
The texture of the 640-gram paper literally creates a record of the passage of time.
A physical timeline.
Those uncorrected watermarks register exactly how long it took the water to naturally evaporate on that specific day. It's quite literally a memory of the climate in his studio embedded into the artwork.
The wall has lived through a span of time, which actually transitions us from the physical materials into the psychological weight of the piece.
Because the color itself is so heavy.
Right. Because the heavy texture requires deeply saturated pigments to fill those valleys, the wall is dominated by an overwhelming saturating blue.
And this is not a cheerful, sunny Mediterranean sky blue.
Not at all.
The artist explicitly labels it a psychological blue.
It acts as an enormous mechanism of containment. It doesn't open the space up. It isolates the scene.
It traps you.
It does. It forces a deep, almost uncomfortable introspection on the viewer. It creates a sensation of physical silence.
It really does. I feel it just looking at it.
Mm.
But right in the middle of this suffocating blue wall is a violently vibrant red door.
Yes, the red door.
And honestly, this is where I'm struggling a bit with Duke's notes. He refers to this door as an unresolved transit.
Right.
But culturally, in art and architecture, a red door is traditionally a very positive symbol.
Usually, yes.
It signifies a warm welcome, a safe haven. You see a red door on a house and you think, oh, I can seek refuge here. So why is he using it to create tension?
Because in this specific environment, the red completely clashes with the coldness of the blue.
Oh, so it doesn't warm the scene.
Not at all. Consider the lighting in the piece. There's no explicit source of light in the painting. No sun casting a shadow, no street lamp illuminating the entrance.
It's just kind of glowing.
The light is almost clinical, emanating entirely from the tension between the red and the blue itself. So instead of a warm hearth, the door functions more like an open wound against that massive wall.
An open wound. Wow. That completely changes how I view it.
It's unsettling.
It really is. Mm. The geometry of the wall is perfectly parallel to the viewer. It's a rigid physical limit you cannot jump over.
You're stuck in front of it.
Right. So the door is right there in front of you, centered and vibrant, offering the promise of a welcome, but simultaneously guaranteeing total confinement.
Because you know you cannot open it.
Right.
That is why he calls it an unresolved transit. It's a door that mocks the very idea of a doorway. It's viscerally inaccessible.
Which grounds this abstract art right back into our daily reality.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like when you're walking down the street or standing on a crowded subway.
Yeah.
And you lock eyes with someone.
Yes, exactly.
There's an opportunity for a connection. There's the red door. But out of fear or social conditioning, you both immediately look down at your phones.
You avoid it.
Yeah. You leave the transit unresolved. You choose the confinement.
That is a phenomenal parallel. And it leads perfectly to the only signs of life in the entire painting.
Right, because there are no humans.
Exactly. If the door is inaccessible, who is actually experiencing this heavy isolation?
Right.
There are no humans. But Duke introduces two elements he calls silent counterweights.
Down at the very base of this oppressive blue wall, there's a small, highly contained tree.
Right. And perched at the extreme top edge, on the upper cornice of the wall, there is a raven.
They share the same physical frame, but they're light years apart visually.
They do not interact in any way whatsoever.
Duke uses this separation to explore the concept of soledad compartida, right? Which translates to shared loneliness.
Yes, and this is the crux of how city living creates profound individual solitude.
That concept hits so hard for anyone who has ever lived in a metropolis.
Oh, absolutely.
You can be on that subway car we just talked about, physically pressed up against dozens of other people.
Just surrounded by humanity.
Yeah, you're completely surrounded by towering concrete architecture, blazing neon lights, your phone is buzzing with notifications, and yet in that exact moment, you can feel a sense of absolute crushing individual solitude.
We all recognize that specific brand of isolation. Mm-hmm. It occurs not when we're alone in a forest, but when we are completely enveloped by the overwhelming, inflexible structures of our own making.
We build our own cages.
We do. And within this structure, the raven plays a crucial symbolic role. It's a recurring motif for Duke, serving as a mute witness.
It sits high up on the cornice. Just observing the isolation.
It doesn't intervene.
It doesn't try to fly down to the tree.
It just watches. And the tragedy of the piece lies in what that raven represents for us.
What does it represent?
It mirrors our own passive acceptance of the isolating walls we have built.
Oh, man.
We construct these massive societal barriers, these unresolved red doors. And instead of tearing them down or trying to open them, we just perch on the edge and assimilate into the loneliness.
We just accept the wall as a fact of life.
Exactly.
Which highlights the most striking contrast in the entire piece. You have this inflexible, heavy, man-made architectural barrier, the wall and the door.
Right.
But just above the cornice where the raven sits, there's a tiny sliver of infinite open sky.
It's the juxtaposition between humanity's rigid, self-imposed limits and the boundless open infinity of the natural world.
The sky is the only escape.
Yet the raven chooses to sit on the man-made wall.
Wow. So we've explored the physics of the 640-gram paper, the passage of time in the breathing wall, the psychological clash of the blue and red, and the shared disconnection of the raven.
It's a lot of layers.
Usually, this is where the story of an artwork ends. The paint dries, the artist signs it, and it hangs in a gallery.
Right, the final product.
But reading the final pages of the Trastiago Pintura Artistica notes, Duke does something I find incredibly jarring.
He essentially starts reviewing his own painting.
Yeah. He opens a window into profound creative vulnerability. He didn't just finish the painting and move on to the next project.
No, he ruthlessly questioned his own finished work in writing, engaging in a game of what if with his own masterpiece.
I think this is such an important revelation, especially for students who spend hours trying to interpret complex artistic symbolism.
Oh, definitely.
We often assume that masterful art flows perfectly from the brain to the brush, that it's divinely inspired and executed without a second thought.
Right, the flawless genius myth.
Dismantling that myth is so refreshing. What exactly was he second-guessing?
Well, he looks at that hard-defined straight line where the rigid blue wall meets the infinite clear sky at the top of the painting.
Oh.
And he asks himself, what if I had let the heavy paper act up one more time? What if I had used a final flood of water to intentionally dissolve and blur that hard border between the man-made wall and the natural sky?
Wait, if he dissolves that border, the human structure would seem to literally melt into the air.
Yes. And he analyzes the psychological impact that choice would have had.
That would drastically heighten the existential dread.
It really would.
The wall is oppressive, yes, but at least it's solid. It gives you a boundary. If the wall starts dissolving into the sky, it destroys whatever tiny remaining sense of security the viewer might have had.
You'd be left with nothing to ground you.
Exactly.
He also ponders if he should have used subtler variations in the blue watercolor to add even more atmospheric depth to the breathing wall.
It's this constant searching curiosity.
Yes, he's questioning if he made the isolation too rigid.
But ultimately, he steps back from the what-ifs. He decides to leave the hard border intact.
He does.
And in his notes, he arrives at a definitive conclusion about what Solo represents. He categorizes it as an artwork of pause.
That phrase perfectly encapsulates the mission of the painting.
Artwork of pause.
It's not meant to be a loud, preachy political message about the alienation of modern urban planning.
It doesn't shout at the viewer.
Instead, it quietly demands your observation. It forces you to pause, to look at the unyielding wall and the inaccessible door, and to simply sit with that shared disconnection.
So, to trace the journey we just took, we started with the sheer physical limits of heavy paper, inundated with water and granular pigment in a California studio.
A very physical process.
We saw how the artist allowed evaporation to turn that paper into a breathing record of time.
Using the natural climate.
From there, we plunged into the psychological weight of the piece, the crushing blue wall colliding with an impossible red door that offers confinement disguised as a welcome.
The open wound.
And finally, we found the only life in the painting, the silent, disconnected counterweights of the tree and the raven, passively observing our shared urban loneliness, perched right at the boundary between our self-imposed barriers and the infinite sky.
It's a profound journey, and as we wrap up this deep dive into Duke's work, I want to turn this directly over to you, the listener.
Okay, attorney mayor.
Because analyzing a painting is only half the work, the other half is letting it change how you navigate your own reality.
How so?
Well, as you commute today, as you walk through the concrete grid of your city, or even as you sit in a bustling office surrounded by coworkers, take a moment to observe your environment.
Look around you.
Ask yourself, what are your modern ravens? Who or what are the silent witnesses to your own assimilated loneliness?
That's a tough question.
It is. Perhaps it's the glowing screen of your smartphone acting as a comfortable, passive barrier between you and the person sitting just inches away on the train.
We just accept the phone as the wall. We're the raven perching on it.
Exactly. And perhaps more importantly, examine the architecture of your own daily life. How many red doors do you encounter?
The unresolved transits.
Yes. How many unresolved transits and opportunities for genuine human connection do you walk past every single day simply out of fear of what might be required of you if you actually tried to open them?
It's always easier to just accept the heavy blue wall than to risk opening the red door.
Much easier.
It brings us right back to the paradox we started with. We constantly look for a face, for a tear or a smile, searching for an easy connection.
But sometimes the most profound reflections of our humanity aren't found in a painted face.
They're found in the empty spaces, the tactile scars on heavy paper, and the isolating structures we choose to build around ourselves. Keep questioning those details.
Never stop looking.
Never take the walls around you for granted, and never stop looking for the connection hidden within the isolation. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you on the next deep dive.